Now, I think it's fair to say Donald Kerr is a man who is obsessed with people who collect things. Things like books and manuscripts mostly. The former head of the Special Collections at the University of Otago Library has written numerous books on fascinating New Zealand characters, collectors and collections. They include Hocken, Prince of Collectors, The Smell of Powder, A History of Duelling in New Zealand, and Amassing Treasures for All Times, Sir George Grey, Colonial Bookman and Collector. His latest book, which is nearing completion, is about a man named Ernie Webber. Not a name most Kiwis would be familiar with, but someone with a fascinating story. Born in Dunedin, this railway enthusiast lived a life that movies are made of. A fraudster, a gun dealer, and part of the underground gay culture. Now, I'd never met author Donald Kerr before, but as I was catching the ferry to work on Friday, we struck up a conversation. I spied a manila folder he was holding, and like any journalist, I have the ability to read upside down. The folder had a heading called Mount Eden Prison 1960. And for the next 12 minutes, Donald gave me a quick précis of his latest book. So I invited him into the studio later on Friday to tell us all about the man known as Ernie Webber.
Well, Webber is, I'm a man, I do books on collectors and primarily, and Ernie Webber is was a collector of railway materials, and he was lucky to do some extensive travelling throughout New Zealand, Australia, Hong Kong, India, Pakistan, and all the while he's not only riding the rails, he's collecting timetables, blueprints, books, publications on the rail, rail systems, signals, you name any aspect that of the rail he's dabbling into. And he amasses this huge collection of railway material that sits at Otago University.
Now, when was he born and when did he die?
He was born 1905 and dies 1983. He born in Dunedin and died in Dunedin. But in that interim period, he's Auckland, Sydney, Hong Kong, as I say, India, Pakistan, roaming around Sri Lanka, or Ceylon as it was then, and back to Auckland, where he had a company that he formed and had a busy life, really. Yes, doing lots of things.
So he was so much more than a collector of railway memorabilia,
yes,
wasn't
he?
It's a colourful life. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, he seemed to collect himself, to be honest, because the Hocken Library has his papers, and I think it's... I haven't seen the physical size of it, but from memory or from urban myth, it's the largest personal collection they've got of an archive of a man. And so there's all these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of scrapbooks which have stuff in them. And he collected these things and pasted them into these scrapbooks. And it ranges from his visionary notions of having a line running from Dunedin to Fiordland back in 1936, with estates and ranches on the side to cater to tourists, through to his life in King's Cross, then his partnership with a man called Francis One Arm Sutton. And Sutton was an engineer, railway man, but also a munitions expert, a worldwide known expert on munitions. And he teamed up with Ernie in Hong Kong in 1940.
And what did they get up to? And firstly, why was he named One Arm?
He had this propensity to throw back the grenades that the Turks, the people in the First World War, had thrown to him. And he did this, but of course one day he miscalculated and lost one arm. And he was an adventurer, a bit like Ernie. One of his friends was Two Gun Cohen. And, you know, these lads would, you know, dream up schemes, I guess. And Ernie was part of that scheme whereby they were basically selling arms and armaments to the Chinese warlords, Chiang Kai-shek, and that in the 40s.
So this Kiwi guy was tied up with these other two characters,
yeah,
selling
armaments.
Arms to the... Oh, gosh.
And, of course, the Japanese bombed the place in 41, and Ernie had gotten out of Hong Kong, but Sutton was incarcerated and actually died in one of the camps in 1944. And all the schemes that Ernie and Sutton had were thinking about continuing died, basically, when Sutton died.
What were some of the other schemes, have you managed to find out?
Once again, guns to the Australian government. And it didn't pan out, and it dissipated, and then, of course, Ernie ended up coming back in 1947 to Auckland and living here and his working through his schemes, his business schemes.
Right, and we'll get on to those schemes in a minute. Can I just ask you about the types of guns that he was selling? Did you?
No, well, it's the Owen gun, the sort of automatic. I'm not a gun expert myself, but what I've read about them, they're sort of, you know, they were state-of-the-art. Because Sutton was also making shells and all those sorts of things which would go with these guns. And Sutton was the sort of the true engineer of these very precise machines. Mm. And Ernie was the young visionary, I suppose, helping Sutton sell these things to people.
So he came back to Auckland in 47.
That's correct.
And then what did he get up to?
Well, he started all these... In 1938 in Sydney, he actually was given the rights to start a bank... and he called it the Industrial Banking Corporation. Almost straight after that, the government in Australia said, no, we're not going to give out any licences for banks. And so Ernie had this IBC, which was basically a institution or an agency that helped him form companies and in essence, launder money or form companies around this bank, and he would say, I've got a bank, I can do this and do that, and I'm willing to do this for you if you pay me, and we can do anything we like as a bank. And so he had this bank established in the late 30s, and then he's back in Auckland in 1947, and his investment house, which is, I haven't yet been to it, but it's up on the corner of Victoria and Kitchener by Albert Park there.
Mm.
So his quarters were there, his headquarters was there, and he had the IBC, but also a range of about 34 companies that he had formed. They never did anything.
Mm.
They were just shadow companies. And I'm not a financier. I haven't really got to the grips of what you can do and what you can't do, but he did it, and of course ended up getting charged with fraud.
Right. Okay.
And he got 3 years fraud at Mount Eden Prison, and that was 1960. But see, prior to that, in 1957, he had actually got 3 years for indecent assault.
Right, because getting into the personal life, he was a homosexual.
That's right.
Which, of course, was outlawed.
Yes.
Back in the day.
Yes.
What have you found out about that?
Well, he seemed to be pretty upfront about it, and he's got lots of in his collection. There's a lot of letters and correspondence from his boyfriends, and that makes quite interesting reading. And there's one scholar in Otago who has actually looked at this particular angle of Weber's homosexuality or his gayness, and it has an interesting aspect to it. But he seemed to carry it quite well, I guess, in the times when it wasn't regarded as... It wasn't legal, it was... today I've just been at looking at the Truth newspaper, which covered the trial, and of course the judge calls Ernie a sexual pervert.
Mm.
And one of the defence lawyers actually said, well, look, try to be a little bit lenient and look at the laws that were being pushed through in Westminster at the time, how the Europeans approached homosexuality and gayness, and saying, well, look, you know, try and just be a little bit lenient. But of course the judge didn't, and he sent Ernie to jail, and then of course on top of that homosexuality or the indecent assault charge, he gets the fraud charge. So it's about 6 or 7 years that he's in Mount Eden Prison.
And he believed, Ernie believed, that the charges were all trumped up and...
Yes, there was the notion that there were a couple of his sort of dodgy mates that were pushing this through. And to be honest, I haven't really got the details yet. The articles I found in Truth, haven't read them yet. I even tried to get trial records through the justice system, but I haven't really pursued that too much. You know, the transcripts of the trial, which might reveal the people who made the charges.
Have you read some of those letters that he sent to his lovers and that he received? And what did they write to each other?
They all quite alike. I mean, a lot of them are based when he was living in King's Cross. Mm. And you can imagine King's Cross in the late 30s, 40s. And he's loving the time in King's Cross, and they all meet at these restaurants and are flamboyant. But of course, there's also lovers. There seem to be lovers' tiffs as well, where one of his partners isn't really that. Just wants to sit around. Ernie liked getting out and walking up hills, and he was a bit of an avid sportsman too. He played hockey and all that sort of stuff. So he went out on adventures, and he was moaning and groaning about this particular partner, just wanting to sit at home and, you know, smoke cigarettes and drink green ginger wine. You know, the inn drink.
Tell me, Donald, when did you know about, you know, this whole backstory when you discovered Ernie? Because first and foremost, he was a railway collector, and that's what you were focused on. Yeah. Did you realise there was such a big backstory when you embarked on this project?
Not really, although I had done an exhibition when I was Special Collections Librarian at the University of Otago. I did an exhibition on his railway collecting, and so to work through that, I had to find out stuff at the Hocken about his life in Hong Kong and King's Cross, but not as much as I mean, it's huge, to be honest. It's so much material. I've got to think about marshalling it all into a coherent narrative.
Mm.
And that's the problem.
Mm.
It is such a big collection of, as I said, he saves everything relating to himself and others, perhaps.
What other?
Like, well, I mean, just check books where, check butts, which he collects check butts, and then he makes a list of those significant check butts that he, or sums that he paid out for materials, like a gramophone, and he pays £5 for it because he maintains that this is going to be of interest to the social historian in the future.
Mm.
And, you know, the amount of gas that he puts in his Jag car and school reports, and it's too much, really.
What school did he go to?
Otago Boys.
Otago Boys, right.
Yes, and he was ducks at his father was a railway manager in Owakuni in the sort of central North Island. And I think that's where Ernie certainly got the love of trains and rail and the systems.
Mm.
And he ended up being ducks at that school in Owakuni. And then he was stuck on the third level of the third form at Otago Boys. And there's a scrap of paper that I found because I've dealt with whose teachers were and his marks and all the rest of it. But he says, Otago Boys are not going to be in my will because for some reason they put me in a lower form than what I should have been in. I mean, he was a bit uppity. he's got personal worth, you know, strong personal worth.
Right, right, right.
He thought he should be in the first form, you know, the third, you know, the higher level rather than the third.
Yeah, the top stream or something. Yes, yeah.
And so he just says, "No, I'm wiping them clean." He's quite amusing. He's amusing in some. I mean, he's fun to work with because there is so much going on.
That's
great.
Yeah. So he would drive around in a Jag and streets of Dunedin.
That's right. Called the Wicked Lady.
The Wicked Lady.
Yeah. Yes, he's a. He must have been an identity.
Yeah.
And maybe not so much in Dunedin because he died there, but he'd moved down there about the 70s. But there was things like when boat travel was the thing, he would buy a ticket here at Auckland and go across on a particular boat, a liner, to Sydney and stay in Sydney for 2 days. And then come back again and on the same liner. And another 3 or 4 days later, he'd check in another and go across again. He was basically commuting, really, or thoroughly enjoying. And he's always travelling first class. He always travels first class.
So all of those companies that he had, he was obviously making some sort of money.
Well, you know, he just liked fine things. And, and he, of course, he saves all the menus of this line, you know, the meals that he had on board the boat.
So how was he paying for this extravagant lifestyle?
Well, he worked in a big business firm down in Dunedin for 10 years and got in, it was a finance accounting firm. So he was very, very, I think he was a very bright kid.
Mm.
And he made a lot of money in investments.
He also gave back, didn't he? Because there's this great story that you were telling me about the boy in the bathtub.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So what was that?
The listeners might be interested in this, is that there's this young Swedish cadet. He must have been about 16 or 17. His name was Bertil, and I can't pronounce the last name. Anyhow, he was on board this boat or ship heading north in Australia, and it was becalmed, and Bertil didn't really want to be on board the boat. He actually wanted to be in Australia farming. He liked the idea of agriculture and farming. And when it was becalmed, he jumped into this bath-like structure, and there's a photograph in the papers of this sort of strange little tub, and he rows 5 miles to the nearest island, and then he gets, of course, arrested because he's regarded as an alien immigrant, and gets sent back to Sydney, and he's going to be deported.
Mm.
And Ernie somehow hears about this kid.
This is extraordinary for back in the day when, no internet, there's, papers,
that's right.
Yeah, all of that.
Somewhere in King's Cross he finds out about yeah. Bertil, and he writes, and Ernie wasn't one, his propensity was to go to the top. Underlings didn't interest him. It was people who made decisions, and so he would fire letters to prime ministers and all the rest. Anybody who was top of the echelon in a business. And so he wrote to the Swedish consulate in Sydney and said, "Look, I will take charge of Bertil, this kid. I will arrange something." And so what he did was he ended up coming back to New Zealand by boat and arranging through the principal at the Lincoln Agricultural College outside of Christchurch to get Bertil a place in the agricultural college. And he did. He succeeded. Weber said, "I will pay for his tuition." So for the 2 years that Bertil was at the college, Ernie pays the fees. Ernie also writes to Bertil's folks in Sweden. And these are all saved, all the reports, everything. And he writes to the folks in Sweden and he says, "Bertil now can speak English, he can drive a tractor, and, well, look, I'm going to get him a job." And so that's what he does. He writes to the Wrightson crowd in Dunedin, and he knew a lot of these people through his own workings in the business in Dunedin. And he said, "Look, I've got this chap who's likeable and he speaks English and needs a job," and so he gets him a job out in Cromwell. Not much is known about Bertil, but the Australians seemed to take to the story quite... they thought it was fabulous, this young kid rowing.
In a bathtub.
In a so-called bathtub. That's why he's known as the bathtub sailor.
Wow.
And so Ernie becomes his... And he tracks him down, notices that one of Bertil's sons dies in Whakatane some years later. Well... he cuts out the obituary from the paper and pastes it into all the other papers about Bertil in one of the scrapbooks.
Wow.
And you're just going to have to wade through all this stuff and think, well, he's a fabulous networker. And he cultivates people for his own good. He'll use you as a connection to get somewhere. He's a very interesting, and I think sometimes, gosh, He's swamping me.
Well, this is a fascinating story. How does it end? How did his life end?
Oh, I think probably rather sad in the end. I mean, he's by himself. His mother lives to 93, and she obviously loves. He's the only child, and I think he was. And he forms a scrapbook over the celebrations of her significant birthdays and. So she dies in Auckland, and he ends up back in Dunedin and buys a house there. I think spends a lot of his time scrapbooking and organising, because he's not only scrapbooking his life, but he's also amassing. I mean, throughout this whole journey, he's collecting collecting railway books, railway publications, magazines. He's writing with his Olivetti typewriter, firing off letters to everybody about can I buy those books that you produce, or do we, can we exchange them? And so there's exchange, there's buying, there's gifting, and amassing this huge railway collection. I mean, I've just finished a chapter whereby he has had non-railway materials he was collecting. So he had New Zealand materials. He had quite a substantial New Zealand collection, and he had a fabulous collection of Punch, 1841 to 1941. Yeah. And he gave the 200 the volumes to the Hocken Library. And so the Hocken Library are the benefactors of his interest in country life, Scottish Field, all those sorts of magazines that people would, I suppose, sit down with your green ginger wine and your cigarette or something and dream about fine things. Yeah. Well, maybe not so much Punch, but certainly with country life.
Exactly. Donald, so how far along are you in the book? I mean, when can we expect to
see
it?
Well, I don't know. I've planned 17 chapters and I've done 15.
Right.
But I've only gone through half the collection at the Hocken. So I've got to go back, really, and pester my colleagues down there, my former colleagues, ex-colleagues, about accessing more of the Weber stuff, which will enable me to either to fill in gaps or to find something else out. I mean, I don't know, he might have, even his hotel businesses in Fiji, I mean,
Gosh, you know, it goes on.
It does go on, he's...
The Fabulous Life of Ernie Weber.
Well, you know, the title of...
Have you got a title?
No, probably All Aboard.
Yeah, okay. Right.
All Aboard in his life, activities. I don't know. I'll finish it first and then I'll write up something and send it to somebody and they may take it up. But there's certainly a lot of illustrations that would go with the text, so that's quite good.
Wonderful.
And there is a full life that this man lived, really.
Yeah.
I suppose he represents one of those... I mean, it's true. There's people out there who have rich lives, and there's lots of unwritten histories.
What makes a... I mean, you are especially focused on collectors. What sort of person is a collector? For him, there's this huge collection of railway memorabilia. What sort of person?
I am always fascinated by these people who spend all their time and money and effort in amassing these things. And in particular, what they do is they then give them to institutions, giving them to the people, like Sir George Grey, like Alexander Turnbull in Wellington, like A.H. Reid in Dunedin Public. These people have amassed their medieval manuscripts or their Charles Dickens books or their Milton collections, and they end up giving them to the country, and for us to use. And I think that's fabulous. And I just... Weber is unknown.
Yes.
And so it's kind of nice to discover this man.
Yeah.
And in fact, kind of interesting because it would be nice to for people to be more aware of the collection and thus use it. Yeah.
Wonderful. Donald Kerr, this has been a real treat. Really look forward to reading it, and all the best with your the following few chapters.
Thanks, Anna. That's great.
Donald Kerr. Everyone has a great story, and it was so serendipitous. I got to stand next to Donald on Friday.